It's the 29th of July, 2025, and this is the Arizona Daily Star, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant. And on the front page, we have monsoon rain slightly below average so far. This is from Sierra Blazer of the Arizona Daily Star. The official stats confirm the way it feels. Tucson's monsoon rainfall is slightly below average so far this summer. As of Monday afternoon, the city had 1.88 inches of rain since the monsoon season officially began on June 15th, and all of it came in July, according to the National Weather Service. That's 0.17 inches below normal for the season so far. As the monsoon approaches its August 7th halfway point, last July, the Weather Service recorded 3.41 inches, nearly 2 inches of which came from a single storm system that knocked out trees and caused damage across central and northwest Tucson. This month, after a week of dryness that put us behind, chances of rain return this week, with a 20% chance today on Tuesday, a 30% chance on Wednesday, and a 40% chance Thursday, according to the Weather Service. Temperatures are expected to remain in the low hundreds this week, with a high of 104 Tuesday, 103 Wednesday, and 100 Thursday before rising to 102 on Friday. We're seeing a typical pattern for the monsoon throughout the rest of August, Weather Service forecaster Kevin Strongman said on Monday. It's looking like equal chances, so it could be wetter, it could be drier, but it's going to look like a typical August pattern. In 2024, the city experienced a split monsoon season, half wet, half dry. Tucson recorded 5.39 inches of rain in the first half of last year's monsoon, June 15th to August 8th, and only 0.41 inches in the second half, August 9th to September 30th, the Weather Service reported. Volunteers support migrants at courts. This is from Martha Belisle, Cedar Atanasio, and Colleen Slevin of the Associated Press. Seattle. After a Seattle immigration judge dismissed the deportation case against a Colombian man, exposing him to expedited removal, three people sat with him in the back of the courtroom, taking his car keys for safekeeping, helping him memorize phone numbers and gathering the names of family members who needed to be notified. When Judge Brett Patchert asked why they were doing that in court, the volunteers said immigration and custom enforcement officers were outside the door waiting to take the man into custody. So this is their only chance to help him get his things in order. ICE is in the waiting room, the judge asked. As mass deportation campaign focuses on cities and states led by Democrats and unleashes fear among asylum seekers and immigrants, their legal defenders sued this month, seeking class action protections against the arrests outside immigration court hearings. Meanwhile, these volunteers are taking action. A diverse group, faith leaders, college students, grandmothers, retired lawyers and professors, showed up at immigration courts across the United States to escort immigrants at risk of being detained by masked ICE officials for deportation. They're giving families moral and logistical support and bearing witness as people are taken away. The Northwest Immigrant Rights Project was inundated by so many community members wanting to help that it made a volunteer training video, created Know Your Rights sheets in several languages, and started a Google sheet where people sign up for shifts, said Stephanie Guy, a staff attorney with the Seattle-based legal services nonprofits. Robbie Rohr, a retired nonprofit director, said she volunteers regularly. Being here makes people feel like they are remembered and recognized, she said. It's such a bureaucratic, confusing process. We're trying to help them get through it. Volunteers and legal aid groups long provided free legal orientations in immigration court, but the arrests posed new challenges. Since May, the government asked judges to dismiss the deportation cases. Once the judge agrees, ICE officials arrest the people in the hallways and put them on the fast-track deportation proceedings, no matter which legal immigration pathway they pursued. Once in custody, it's often harder to find or afford a lawyer. Immigration judges are executive branch employees. While some resisted Homeland Security lawyers' dismissal orders, many are granted. Masked ICE agents grabbed the Colombian man and led him into the hallway. A volunteer took his backpack to give to his family when he was taken away. Other cases on the day's docket involved immigrants who didn't show up. Patchert granted removal in absentia orders, enabling ICE to arrest them later. Asked about these arrests and the volunteers at the immigration courts, a senior spokesperson with the Department of Homeland Security said, ICE is implementing the rule of law by reversing Biden's catch-and-release policy that allowed millions of unvetted illegal aliens to be let loose on American streets. Some volunteers recorded arrests in courtroom hallways. How many similar scenes are happening nationwide remains unclear. The Executive Office for Immigration Review hasn't released numbers of cases dismissed or arrests made at or near immigration courts. While most volunteers did this work without incident, some were arrested for interfering with ICE agents. New York City comptroller and Democratic mayoral candidate Brad Lander was arrested after locking arms with a person in a failed attempt to prevent his detention. Lander's wife, attorney Meg Barnett, had just joined him in walking migrants from a courtroom into the elevator. The volunteers' act of witnessing proved to be important as people disappear into a detention system that can seem chaotic, leaving families without any information on their whereabouts. In a waiting room serving New York City immigration courtrooms, a Spanish-speaking woman with long, dark, curly hair sat anxiously with her daughter after she and her husband had separate hearings. He was nowhere to be found. The Reverend Fabian Arias, a volunteer court observer, said the woman, whose first name is Alva, approached him asking, "Where is my husband?" She showed him his photo. ICE detained him, Arias told her, and tried to comfort her as she trembled, later welling up with tears. A judge did not dismiss the husband's case, giving him until October to find a lawyer. That didn't stop ICE agents from handcuffing him and taking him away as soon as he stepped out of court. The news sparked an outcry by immigration advocates, city officials, and a congressman. At a news conference, she only gave her first name and asked why her daughter be named be withheld. Paris Thomas began volunteering at the Denver Immigration Court after hearing about the effort through a network of churches. Wearing a straw hat, he recently waited in the midday heat, for people to arrive for afternoon hearings. He handed people a small paper flyer listing their rights in Spanish on one side and English on the other. One man walking with a woman told him, "Thank you, thank you." Another man gave him a hug. Trump talks Gaza and golf. This is from Will Weissert of the Associated Press, Edinburgh, Scotland. President Donald Trump used his luxury golf course on Scotland's coast Monday to host British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, mixing critical discussions on the deepening food crisis in Gaza, Russia's war in Ukraine, and tariff rates with boasts about the property's opulence. Trump often treated the sit-down as if he were back in the Oval Office, while also not missing the chance to talk up his Turnberry course, which enriches his family business. When the Prime Minister and his wife, Victoria, arrived at Trump Turnberry, the Republican president spent several minutes chatting with them and proudly pointing out key sites around the property. Starmer came determined to press the U.S. to take a larger role in helping quell what he called a desperate situation amid increasing reports of starvation in Gaza as the Israeli-Hamas war rages. Trump at first was focused on complaining about the U.S. not having gotten enough credit for previously providing food aid. He shifted tone when reporters questioned him about images of emaciated children from Gaza. When asked if he agreed with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks about concerns of mass starvations in Gaza being overstated, he replied, "I don't know. I mean, based on television, I would say it's not particularly... because those children look very hungry. Starmer immediately was far more forceful. I think people in Britain are revolted at seeing what they are seeing on their screens. The president later shifted his tone dramatically and suggested a major recalibration of U.S. policy towards the territory, suggesting that Israel has a lot of responsibility for what's happening. I think Israel can do a lot, Trump said. He claimed that when next speaking to Netanyahu, he'd insist, I want them to make sure they get the food, noting that the U.S. and others giving money and food to Gaza, and that Netanyahu has got to sort of, like, run it. Golf courses. After their meeting, Starmer flew with Trump aboard Air Force One to outside Aberdeen, where the president's family has a second golf course and is holding a ribbon cutting for a third Tuesday. Demonstrators protested at Balmady, a village close to the golf course. One of them, Gene Abbott, a 67-year-old retired legal professional, accused Trump of being in the process of dismantling Western civilization. He's trashing what two generations of our people fought wars to preserve, namely democracy and freedom and the rule of law, Abbott said. That followed protests across Scotland and on Saturday, decrying the president's visit as he golfed. The president talked at length Monday about how he spent money lavishly to upgrade the historic Turnberry course after he bought it in 2014, declaring, if you take a look out at the windows in the various dining rooms, they're magnificent. Starmer said he was excited to see this amazing golf course, while promising Trump, I'll invite you to the football ground at some stage. Ukraine. Britain, along with France and Germany, criticized Israel for withholding essential humanitarian assistance in Gaza as hunger spreads. Over the weekend, Starmer said Britain will take part in efforts led by Jordan to airdrop aid into Gaza after Israel temporarily erased restrictions. Starmer is also under pressure from his Labour Party lawmakers to follow France in recognizing a Palestinian state, a move Israel and the U.S. previously condemned. Trump said Monday of the Prime Minister potentially doing so, I don't mind him taking a position. Starmer has said that the U.K. supports statehood for the Palestinians, but it must be part of a wider plan for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Trump and Starmer also talked about a possible peace deal to end fighting in Russia's war with Ukraine, particularly trying to force Russian President Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table with a 50-day window Trump set earlier this month. The president said he wants to announce a new window to halt the fighting in just 10 or 12 days, saying there's no reason in waiting. Like being at the White House. As the leaders took more than an hour of the reporters' questions, their sit-down at times played out like Trump's meetings with foreign leaders in the Oval Office. There, he fields multiple questions while his guests mostly sit quietly, even though this meeting took place in Starmer's UK. Trump batted away persistent inquiries about the Jeffrey Epstein case and recapped his push for the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. He also repeated his long-standing grudge against wind farms, which he sued unsuccessfully to get removed from near his golf course in the Aberdeen area. At another point, Trump criticized London Mayor Sadiq Khan by saying he's done a terrible job and that he's a nasty person. Starmer jumped in with a chuckle. He's a friend of mine, actually. They also talked about refining a bilateral trade agreement that they announced last month, but there's still some sticking points around steel imports. The meeting followed Trump sitting down after golfing on Sunday with European Commissioner Chief Ursula von der Leyen. They announced a trade framework that will put 15% tariffs on most goods from both countries, though many major details remain pending. Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina sees politics snarl recognition by Washington. It's from Graham Lee Brewer of the Associated Press. Since the 1980s, the Lumbee Tribe has lobbied Congress to acknowledge it as a sovereign nation. There was renewed hope last year when both major party candidates in the presidential election promised to intervene on behalf of the Lumbee. That's Lumbee. In his first week in office, President Donald Trump appeared to make good on his endorsement. He issued an executive order directing the Interior Department to create a plan for federal recognition, a move Lumbee Chairman John Lowry called a significant step forward. But several months later, it remains unclear if Trump will take further action. The plan was submitted to the White House in April, according to the Interior Department. However, a White House official told the Associated Press last week that the Lumbee will have to achieve its goal through legislation, which the Interior Department also confirmed. We anticipate the tribe will work with Congress on a path forward to be formally recognized, Interior spokesperson Elizabeth Peace said in a statement. Federal acknowledgement comes with a bevy of resources owed to tribal nations through treaty rights and acts of Congress, including health care through the Indian Health Service, access to certain federal grants, and the ability to create a land base such as reservations through the Land to Trust process. Many of the 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S. have been acknowledged through legislation. Dozens more have been recognized through the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, which determines if applicants have a documented history of political and social existence as a tribe. Critics of the Lumbee tribe, including several tribal nations, argue that it has not been able to prove its historic and genealogical claims and that it should do so through formal federal process. The tribe is recognized by the state of North Carolina. The gaps in the Lumbee's claims are staggering, said Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians Principal Chief Mitchell Hicks. He said that the Lumbee have yet to show who they descend from and that recognizing them through legislation would open the door for fraudulent groups to gain federal acknowledgement. Congress wouldn't be recognizing a tribe, it would be manufacturing one, he said. Lowry argues that the Lumbee can prove who they descend from, but that the application and vetting process through the Office of Federal Acknowledgement is too long and arduous and could take decades to complete. He has been working closely with Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina to pass a bill that would federally recognize the Lumbee tribe. For anyone from any tribe to somehow think that a tribe that receives federal recognition via legislation is somehow circumventing the process, Lowry said, is being disingenuous. The Lumbee tribe applied for recognition in 1987, but Arlinda Locklear, a Lumbee attorney who has worked on the issue for decades, said that the staff of the Office of Federal Acknowledgement offered conflicting opinions because of a 1956 congressional act acknowledged that the Lumbee exist, but denied them access to federal resources. She said they asked the office to issue a formal opinion regarding the 1956 bill. If we're not eligible, then tell us that at the beginning so we can ask for it from Congress, she said. The Office of Federal Acknowledgement determined that the Lumbee tribe was ineligible for recognition, but that a decision was reversed in 2016 by Interior Offices of the Solicitor. Despite being allowed to reapply since 2016, both Lowry and Locklear said that the process remains too lengthy and have opted instead to urge Congress to pass legislation. That could prove difficult in the current climate as Trump and Republican lawmakers are slashing federal spending. In 2011, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that recognizing the Lumbee tribe and providing the necessary federal resources would cost the U.S. more than $480 million in the first 4 years. A 2022 CBO estimate put that number at more than $360 million. This month, a Brookings Institution report found that the Trump administration's directive to freeze federal grants could disrupt $24 billion that go to tribes. Tillis, the author of the bill, has also been subject to of the Trump's ire recently after he voted against the Trump's against the president's tax bill in June. Trump threatened to campaign against him, and Tillis said he would not seek re-election. His bill, the Lumbee Fairness Act, was referred to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs in January. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who chairs the committee, said she will work with Tillis on the bill. David Wilkins, a Lumbee author and professor at the University of Richmond, has advocated for federal recognition for decades, but he said the Lumbee face opposition across Indian country, and he's concerned that gaining it with Trump's endorsement will add to that. The way he's battering Indian country with his cuts or with his layoffs, Wilkins said, if we do slip through because Trump convinces his Secretary of Interior to either expedite the acknowledgement process or get Congress to finally move on the Lumbee bill and get it through, I worry that's how it's going to be received in Indian country. At 20 minutes past the hour, let's turn to national and world news. Reno, Nevada. Gunman kills two, injures several. Police shoot and arrest a suspect outside the casino after a shooting spree. Andy Barron and Ariel Yamat of the Associated Press. Reno, Nevada. A gunman opened fire early Monday outside the largest casino in Reno, Nevada, killing two people and injuring at least three others before being taken in custody, officials said. The suspected shooter at the Grand Sierra Resort was among those transported to the hospital, said Dr. Chad Kingsley, a district health officer for the Northern Nevada Public Health Department. Authorities said police shot the suspect before arresting them. The suspect was taken into custody and transported to local area hospital, police said in a statement. The suspect's condition is unknown at this time. The resort is one of Reno's most prominent venues, hosting concerts, sporting events, and a campaign rally by President Donald Trump before the 2024 election. Near the California border and just northeast of Lake Tahoe, the town is a popular summer tourist destination. One witness said he heard several shots ring out near the resort's valet area. Michael Sisko, 60, was about to leave his room at the resort and head to the valet for his car when he heard popping sounds. He looked out his window and saw people screaming and running from the valet area, he said. Sisko said he saw a man holding his stomach and staggering before falling motionless next to a car. Sisko moved away from the window as gunshots continued. The resort informed guests on an intercom that a situation involving police had unfolded, Sisko said. A half hour after the incident, I started shaking because I realized I could have been there, he said. That's exactly where I was going. The shooting was reported about 7:30 a.m. Monday outside, the police said. In addition to the fatalities and the people taken to the hospital, three more individuals were treated for minor injuries on the scene, according to Devin Reese, chair of the Board of Health in Northern Nevada. One person was grazed by a bullet on their pinky finger, and one was treated for severe anxiety, and one was injured while running, he said. More than a year ago, two men were charged with fatally shooting another man who was staying at the same resort in January 2024. Planned Parenthood. Judge blocks defunding. Administration's effort likely to disrupt health care, court decides. Kimberly Crucey. This is Associated Press again. A federal judge ruled Monday that Planned Parenthood clinics nationwide must continue to be reimbursed for Medicaid funding as the nation's largest abortion provider fights President Donald Trump's administration over efforts to defund the organization in his signature tax legislation. The new order replaces a previous edict handed down by U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani in Boston last week. Talwani initially granted a preliminary injunction specifically blocking the government from cutting Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood members so that didn't provide abortion care or didn't meet a threshold of at least $800,000 in Medicaid reimbursements in a given year. Patients are likely to suffer adverse health consequences where care is disrupted or unavailable, Talwani wrote in her Monday order. In particular, restricting members' ability to provide health care services threatens an increase in unintended pregnancies and attendant complications because of reduced access to effective contraceptives and an increase in undiagnosed and untreated STIs. A provision in Trump's tax bill instructed the federal government to end Medicaid payments for 1 year to abortion providers that received more than $800,000 from Medicaid in 2023, even to those like Planned Parenthood that also offer Medicare medical services. Though Planned Parenthood is not specifically named in the statute, which went into effect July 4th, the organization's leaders say it was meant to affect their nearly 600 centers in 48 states. However, a major medical provider in Maine and likely others have also been hit. In her Monday order, Talwani said that the court was not enjoining the federal government from regulating abortion and is not directing the federal government to fund elective abortions or any health care services not otherwise eligible for Medicaid coverage. In its lawsuit, Planned Parenthood argued that they would be at risk of closing almost 200 clinics in 24 states if they are cut off from Medicaid funds. They estimated this would result in more than 1 million patients losing care. "We're suing the Trump administration over this targeted attack on Planned Parenthood health centers and the patients who rely on them for care," Planned Parenthood President and CEO Alexis McGill Johnson said Monday. "This case is about making sure that patients who use Medicaid as their insurance to get birth control, cancer screening, and STI testing and treatment can continue to do so at their local Planned Parenthood health center, and we will make that clear in court." And in the News Digest, lawyers allege abuse at Alligator Alcatraz. Civil rights lawyers seeking a temporary restraining order against an immigration detention center in the Florida Everglades say Alligator Alcatraz detainees are barred from meeting with attorneys and are being held without charges. There, they also said that a federal immigration court canceled bond hearings. The immigration attorneys argued Monday during a virtual hearing that the detainees' constitutional rights were violated, that 100 detainees had already been deported from the Florida facility. Lawyers who showed for bond hearings for Alligator Alcatraz detainees were told that the immigration court doesn't have jurisdiction over their clients, and that the civil rights attorneys demanded that federal and state officials identify an immigration court that has jurisdiction over the detainees so that it can start accepting petitions for bond. Thailand, Cambodia agree to a ceasefire. Putrajaya, Malaysia. Thailand and Cambodia agreed to an unconditional ceasefire Monday during a meeting in Malaysia, a significant breakthrough to resolve 5 days of deadly border clashes that killed dozens and displaced tens of thousands. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Manet and Thai Acting Prime Minister Phuthanam Wattiracai agreed to halt in fighting starting at midnight while appearing with Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim during a meeting held under U.S. pressure in the Malaysian administrative capital of Putrajaya. The Cambodian and Thai leaders hailed the meeting's outcomes and shook hands at the end of a brief news conference. Briefly, officer sentenced. Former Columbus, Ohio police officer Adam Coy, who is convicted in the murder of the shootings of Andre Hill, a black man who is held holding a cell phone and keys when he was killed, was given mandatory sentence Monday of 15 years to life. Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes and gunfire killed at least 78 Palestinians on Monday across the Gaza Strip, including a pregnant woman whose baby was delivered after her death but also died, local health officials said. Dozens were killed while seeking food, even as Israel moved to ease restriction on the entrance of aid. Argentina. The United States and Argentina announced Monday that they are working on a plan to allow Argentine tourists to again travel to the U.S. without a visa. The Trump administration's move to kickstart the process marked a show of support for President Javier Milei, a darling of conservatives around the globe. Rupert Murdoch. President Donald Trump asked a federal court Monday in Florida to force Rupert Murdoch, 94, to give a deposition for the president's lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal within 15 days, citing the media mogul's age and physical condition. Temu, a European Union watchdogs, accused Chinese retailer, online retailer Temu on Monday of failing to prevent the sale of illegal products on its platform. The preliminary findings follow an investigation opened last year under the bloc's Digital Service Act. Tropical weather. A hurricane that developed rapidly Monday in the central Pacific Ocean was not expected to cause a problem for Hawaii, a federal meteorologist said, as Hurricane Iona trekked west across warm, open waters. And this has been from the Associated Press. And there's a podcast. You can snap this code, then tap the link to hear our latest daily podcast called Hot Off the Wire. Japan's offer of $550 billion is not a sure thing. This is from Josh Boak and Mari Yamaguchi of the Associated Press. Washington. President Donald Trump is bragging that Japan gave him, as part of a new trade framework, a $550 billion to invest in the United States. It's an astonishing figure, but still subject to negotiation and perhaps not the sure thing he's portraying. Japan is putting up $550 billion in order to lower their tariffs a little bit, Trump said Thursday. They put up, as you could call it, seed money. Let's call it seed money. He said 90% of any profits from the money invested would go to the U.S., even if Japan put up the funds. It's not a loan or anything. It's a signing bonus, the Republican president said, on the trade framework that lowered his threatened tariff from 25% to 15%, including on autos. A White House official said that the terms are being negotiated and nothing has been formalized in writing. The official, who insisted on anonymity to detail the terms of the talk, suggested the goal was for the $550 billion fund to make investments at Trump's direction. The sum is significant. It would represent more than 10% of Japan's entire gross domestic product. That the Japan External Trade Organization estimates that the direct investment in the U.S. economy topped $780 billion in 2023. It's unclear the degree to which the $550 billion would represent a new investment or flow into the existing investment plans. What the trade framework announced last week achieved is a major talking point for the Trump administration. The president claimed to have brought trillions of dollars in new investment into the U.S. through the impact of those commitments has yet to appear in the economic data for jobs, construction spending, or manufacturing output. The framework also enabled Trump to say that other countries were agreeing to have their goods taxed, even if some of the cost of those taxes ultimately passed on to U.S. consumers. On the $550 billion, Japan's cabinet office said it involves credit facility of state-affiliated finance institutions such as Japan Bank for International Cooperation. Further details would be decided based on the progress of the investment deals. Japanese trade negotiator Ryoshi Akazawa, upon returning to Japan, did not discuss the terms of the $550 billion investment. Akazawa said he believes a written joint statement is necessary, at least on working levels, to avoid differences. He's not thinking about a legally binding trade pact. The U.S. apparently released its version of the deal while Japanese officials were on their flight home. If we find differences of understanding, we may have to point them out and say that's not what we discussed, Akazawa said. The U.S. administration said that the fund would be invested in critical minerals, pharmaceuticals, computer chips, and shipbuilding, among other industries. It said Japan will also buy 100 airplanes from Boeing and rice from the U.S. farmers as part of the framework, which Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said would be evaluated every 3 months. If the president is unhappy, they will boomerang back to the 25% tariff rates on both on cars and the rest of their products. And I can tell you that I think 25%, especially for cars, The Japanese economy doesn't work. Bessant told Fox News the Ingram angle. Akazawa denied Bessant's quarterly review was part of the negotiations. In my past 8 trips to the United States, during which I had held talks with the president and the ministers, Akazawa said, I have no recollection of discussing how we would ensure the implementation of the latest agreement between Japan and the United States. He said it would cause major disruptions in the economy and administrative processes if the rates first rise to 25% as scheduled on August 1st and then drop to 15%. We definitely want to avoid that, and I believe it's in the understanding that that is the understanding shared by the U.S. side, he said. On buying U.S. rice, Japanese officials said they have no plans to raise a 770,000-ton minimum access cap to import more from America. Agricultural Minister Shinjiro Goizumi said that Japan will decide whether to increase U.S. rice imports and that Japan is not committed to a fixed quota. Whatever Donald Trump wants to build, the Japanese will finance it for him, Lutnick said Thursday on CNBC. Pretty amazing. In Tucson and regional news, nearly 1,300 sent incorrect ballots for the August primaries. This is from Charles Borla of the Arizona Daily Star. The Pima County Recorder's Office said it sent nearly 1,300 voters in Tucson the ballot for the wrong political party ahead of the August 5th primary elections. Tucson voters in wards 3, 5, and 6 should check their ballots, the office said Monday, as nearly 1,294 voters may have inadvertently received the wrong party ballot. The issue was discovered late last week after 3 voters told the recorder's office they had received a mail ballot for the wrong party, the office said. The error was a result of the need for recorder's office staff to override a mechanism within the data system that prevents party changes during an active election, the office said in a news release without elaborating. The override was necessary because of the overlap of 3 elections, the Congressional District 7 Special Primary, the City of Tucson Primary, and the City of South Tucson Special Recall, the release said. A spokesman for the recorder's office, after agreeing to speak Tuesday afternoon with the Star, then declined to answer questions about why the system needed to be overridden. Voters impacted by the error are still eligible to get a ballot at any ballot replacement site now through August 5th, Election Day, the office said. 2 ballot replacement sites are listed on the recorder's office website. The office's main location on 240 North Stone Avenue, that's downtown, and the Sam Lena South Tucson Library, 1607 South 6th Avenue. Voters who've already submitted their ballot or who vote at a replacement site can request a provisional ballot, the office said. To check your voter registration information, check the Pima County Recorder's voter dashboard at recorder.pima.gov. It's not the first election-related error the recorder's office has encountered recently. In April, the office had to ask about 30,000 voters to provide proof of citizenship to rectify a decades-old error for some people who registered to vote through the Arizona Motor Vehicle Division. Last October, ahead of the general election, an addressing problem caused the recorder's office to delay nearly some 267,000 ballots from being sent out. 2 more Project Blue public meetings are set. This is from Charles Borla of the Arizona Daily Star. 2 more meetings about the proposed Project Blue data centers have been scheduled, city officials announced Monday. A virtual meeting will be held Thursday via Microsoft Teams. When the draft development agreement was released earlier this month, an executive summary from city manager Tom Tamor noted that the meeting Thursday was being scheduled at the request of Mayor Regina Romero. The city news release Monday didn't note whether Romero will attend Thursday's meeting. Another meeting has been scheduled for the Tucson Convention Center's Grand Ballroom, 260 South Church Avenue, on Monday, August 4th, from 5 to 7 p.m. City officials, as well as representatives from Tucson Electric Power and Beale Infrastructure Project Blues Developer, will be at both meetings to share information and answer questions regarding the data center projects, the city says. Last week, nearly 800 people packed an auditorium at Mica Mountain High School on the southeast side to hear speakers express concern about the city's ability to properly manage water use by the $3.6 billion project. Soon after, the news broke that a 2023 county memo named Amazon Web Services as the end user of the data centers. Project Blue plans to build two large data center complexes within city limits, with construction starting early next year and extending into the 2030s. A third data center for complex Project Blue will eventually be built, city officials said, but only after the first complex of up to 10 individual data centers has an identified location on 290 acres near the Pima County Fairgrounds on the far southeast side of unincorporated Pima County, just outside city limits. And at 20 minutes before the hour, let's continue. Prison sold to a company that runs ICE facilities. This is from Bob Christie of Capital Media Services. Arizona's first private prison is again owned by the company that built it in the mid-1990s and then sold it to the state in 2013 for $150,000. That's what Centerville, Utah-based Management and Training Corp. has planned for the shuttered 500-bed prison in Marana. It's still not known, even though the company paid Arizona $15 million for the facility. MTC had run the prison until Governor Katie Hobbs ordered it closed at the end of 2023 because the state no longer needed the beds. MTC Communications Director Emily Lawhead said Monday that the company still isn't able to say who the customer might be, when the facility will reopen, and how many employees it will need to hire to staff it. But all eyes are on the federal government as the eventual user, with the Trump administration in the midst of a massive increase in the number of immigration detention beds, both public and private. Terry Rosema, the town manager of Marana, said the company officials told him months ago that it might use the prison as an immigration and customs enforcement detention facility. That makes sense, since Arizona doesn't need the beds for state prisoners, and private prison companies are landing a large number of ICE detention contracts. And MTC's website said it already runs five Immigration and Custom Enforcement Agency detention centers, one in California and four in Texas. State Senator John Kavanaugh has proposed legislation in January for the state to lease the facility to ICE for $1 a year, noting that it would be a big win for immigration hawks like him. The proposal passed the Senate, but was voted down in the state House the day the Department of Administration announced the deal to sell it to MTC. The Fountain Hills Republicans said Monday that having the Marana prison used as an ICE facility would be good news. Although it has 500 beds, Kavanaugh said, an operator could double the capacity to 1,000. I love the idea that we have expedited removal in Phoenix, Kavanaugh said. It'll be removing illegal aliens quicker, and it will possibly scare some of them out of the state. A request for comments sent to ICE's public affairs staff on a possible use of the Marana prison got no immediate response Monday. The deal for the prison, about 30 miles north of Tucson in northern Pima County, closed on July 23rd, and a week earlier than laid out in the April 30th sales agreement with the state. ICE has a large immigration detention facility in the Pinal County city of Eloy that can house as many as 1,500 detainees. It's run by Core Civic, another private prison company. The loss of the private prison was a hit for Marana, both in local jobs and in loss of economic activity by companies that maintained and supplied the prison. At full capacity, the former Arizona State Prison Marana employed more than 200 people, many of whom lived in the town of 63,000. it was classified as a minimum security prison. The town also got increased state-shared revenue when prisoners are counted as residents. Rosema said in May, when state prisoners were held there, they were hired to do outside roadside cleanup and other projects to keep the town pristine, he said. Rosema said earlier that he doubted ICE detainees could be used for outside work projects because of the security concerns. In addition to the five ICE facilities, MTC operates multiple detention or correctional centers in the U.S. and abroad, plus Job Corps training centers and prison medical facilities. And now let's move to the lifestyle section. Hints from Eloise. Your dishwasher can handle dried-on food. Dear Eloise, after reading the letter from Pat D. in Irvine, California, about not putting dishes in the dishwasher with dried food on them, I would like to share my thoughts. I don't hesitate to do this very thing. With the newest dishwasher detergent pods, they have enough enzymes in them to take care of dried-on food. Most newer dishwashers also have soft food disposals in them, which easily takes care of whatever food particles are removed from the dishes. One of the biggest problems with getting dishes clean in the dishwasher is that the water is not hot enough. Another thing is not loading it properly or overloading it. However, it's always best to read the use and care manual of any dishwasher to be certain that you are using it properly. I have read your column for over 55 years and have picked up so many good tips, and I now read it in the Temple Daily Telegram. This is from John S. in Belton, Texas. Throwing away medications. Dear Eloise, never throw away medicines, either prescription or over-the-counter, into the garbage. If your garbage goes into a landfill, the medicine might be washed down into the groundwater or someone's well, and it may be washed into surface water and poisoned streams, rivers, or other people's water. Neither wastewater plants nor water purification plants can remove medications from the water. The next town over has a box for medicines to be disposed of properly. Andy W.B. in Gardiner, New York. Dusting lampshades, dear Eloise. Recently, you suggested using a small paintbrush to dust lampshades. The best thing to use to dust a smooth lampshade is a lint roller. It picks up the dust, whereas a paintbrush will allow the dust to drop into the floor or onto the furniture. All it does is move the dust from one place to another. A lint roller also works well on upholstery, and it picks up any grit or dust on the chairs, sofas, etc. This is from Debbie in North Carolina. And I should add parenthetically, I just use a leaf blower in the house, and it takes care of all the dust. Then I have to open all the doors and hope the wind blows the dust air out of the house. Bitterness in coffee. Dear Eloise, I used to be a coffee salesman, and I found that complaints about bitterness were due to using too little coffee for the amount of water used. Coffee has a limited amount of solubles, which are the source of the flavor. Once hot water removes the solubles, what comes next is oil and acid, which gives a bitter taste and often leaves a film of oil on top. This is from Ed via email. African violets. Dear Eloise, I absolutely love African violets. Every time I see one, it reminds me of my mother's kitchen. She grew them on a long windowsill in her kitchen, and they were just lovely. I've tried to grow them in my house, but I don't seem to have the talent to make them bloom like my mother did. Her flowers were big, while mine are sickly. Got any hints for my plants? Nora K. in Utah. Nora, place some rusty nails in the soil next to the roots, and you'll see a difference. Bigger, brighter blooms. That's from Eloise. You can send a money-saving or time-saving hint to Eloise, Eloise with an H, at Heloise@Heloise.com. Royal Stars from Georgia Nichols. Happy birthday for Tuesday, July 29th, 2025. You are energetic, positive, and tireless. You're also protective and influential. Focus on being more compassionate and loving. For Aries, March 21st through April 19th, tread carefully. because you may find yourself at odds with those closest to your partner's spouses and your closest friends. They might be critical of you. Tonight, socialize. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. Don't challenge people at work today, especially authority figures or coworkers who are older and more experienced. Tonight, join forces. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Children might be an increased responsibility today. Likewise, you might feel a sense of social obligation to others as well. Tonight, party! Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Relations with parents and family members might be strained this morning. Furthermore, you might feel suspicious that someone is not giving you the whole story. Tonight, entertain. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Minor squabbles and negative vibes are discouraging this morning. You might feel that someone is critical of you or going out of their way to discredit you. Ouch! Tonight, conversations. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Be careful about financial matters this morning. Someone might block your efforts, withhold the truth, or deceive you. Tonight, check your money. Libra, September 23rd through August 22nd. October 22nd, sorry. You are a sociable sign. However, this morning you might feel lonely, isolated, or cut off from others. You might even feel guilty or diminished by someone else's actions. Bummer. Tonight, you're strong. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st. Life is difficult this morning. You might feel cut off from others. You might feel left behind or left out of the loop. Obviously, this is discouraging. Tonight, enjoy your privacy. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. A disagreement with a friend, a group, or one of your kids might discourage you this morning. Tonight, mingle with others. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. This morning is challenging because you're high vis, which means some people notice you more than usual. The problem is that you might be at odds with a parent, someone older, or a situation that is family related. Tonight, you're impressive. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Avoid disputes with others, especially about controversial issues this morning, because you can't win. Do something different. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Don't agree to financial issues this morning because you might not have the full picture. Trust no one. Tonight, check your finances. And moving to sports. Arizona football, core cats. 10 Arizona veterans expected to lead UA football. This is from Justin Spears of the Arizona Daily Star. One of the most well-documented stories of Arizona's offseason is the plethora of newcomers that the Wildcats added. However, the U of A has several returners expected to impact the team this season. Over half of Arizona's roster will feature new faces, but there are plenty of multi-year Wildcats expected to have noteworthy roles for the Wildcats. There are 10 Wildcats to pay attention to when Arizona begins fall training camp on Wednesday. You got Noah Fafita, position quarterback. Year, redshirt junior, jersey number 1. His hometown is Huntington Beach, California, and he was previously at Servite High School. Number 2, Kayan Burnett, position tight end. Year, senior, jersey number. His height, weight, 6'6", 248 pounds. He's number 88. His hometown is Ladera Beach, California. Also from Servite High School. Chris Hunter, position wide receiver. Year, redshirt junior. Jersey number 11. Height and weight, 6'1", 193 pounds. Hometown, New Orleans, Louisiana. And his high school was Isidore Newman School. Dalton Johnson, position strong safety. Year, redshirt senior. Jersey number 43, height and weight, 5'11", 198 pounds, hometown Katy, Texas. Previous school, Katy High School. Chuba Ma'ai, position offensive line, redshirt senior. Jersey number 55, height and weight, 6'2", 352 pounds, hometown Long Beach, California. Previous school, he transferred from UC Davis. And that's just some of the top returning players. In other news, JCC, Maccabee Games. Jewish teens converge in Tucson. This is from James Kelly, special to the Arizona Daily Star. Jewish teen athletes from the United States, Canada, Israel, Ukraine, Moldova have converged on the Old Pueblo to compete in Olympic-style events in baseball, basketball, co-ed flag football, soccer, volleyball, dance, golf, and swimming and tennis. It's the first time in 25 years that Tucson is hosting the JCC, Jewish Community Center, I'm assuming, Maccabee Games, which now feature the Access Program, giving Jewish teens and young adults with cognitive and developmental disabilities the opportunity to participate. We are so honored to have this here in Tucson, to be welcoming people, really, from around the world to participate in the games, to come and see our beautiful community, said Tucson JCC President and CEO Todd Rockoff. The games, which kicked off Sunday, with opening ceremonies and competition on Monday, are expected to attract more than 1,000 visitors and generate more than $4 million in local economic impact. First piloted in 2021, the Tucson Games will feature the addition of JCC Maccabee Access, a program for Jewish teens and young adults with cognitive and developmental disabilities. Access is for athletes from age 12 to 22, and they compete in multiple sports. It's amazing. I was part of the creation of the pilot, and there are 3 years of pilots in San Diego, Fort Lauderdale, and Houston. And through that, we refined the program. We really anchored it as a permanent fixture in the JCC Maccabee Games. Moving forward, and we are really honored to be the first community to host Access outside of that pilot, Rockoff said. So this is really the formal inaugural JCC Maccabee Access Games. And we have 25 athletes from a variety of different communities, including four from here in Tucson, that will be participating. Israeli judo champion and Olympic medalist Or Sasson is speaking to the teens at the event, and there will be a musical performance by DJ Artifacts, a survivor of and performer at the Nova Music Festival attack in October 7th, 2023, attacked by Hamas terrorists. The games will also feature JCC Cares, which is part of the service part of the JCC Maccabee experience, displaying Tikkun Olam, Repair of the World, supporting the Diamond Children's Medical Center, Youth on Their Own, and Ben's Bell. We take a break from the competition on Tuesday and Wednesday, and all the teams across the board participate in a project that is giving back to our community here in Tucson, and they'll have an opportunity to learn about two of our really flagship nonprofits, Rockoff said. We're working with Ben's Bells, and we're working with Youth on Their Own, and all the kids will have the opportunity to do some work that will benefit Ben's Bells and Youth on Their Own. But they will also have the opportunity to learn about the very important work that both of them do, and each team that came Sunday got off the plane and brought a specific donation for the play zone at Diamond Children's Hospital. The goal of the games is not just to compete, but to do community service and connect the Jewish community. I think it's remarkable to be able to have a gathering like this where we celebrate Jewish joy, Rockoff said. We help to create pride in who we are as a people and connect people, in this case teens, to one another so that no one feels like they're alone. They all feel like they're part of a wider peoplehood. And this has been the Arizona Daily Star, brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read for you by David Grant. And this is July 29th, 2025. Have a great time until we meet again.